and, you know, whatever I can do to keep these legacies alive and thriving and, you know.
And tonight you'll be at the Audubon Ballroom, which your mother fought to save from destruction when Columbia was building its big biotech building. And there you have so many events honoring Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz.
And I want to say that my mother turned this place of tragedy into a place of triumph.
Dr. Ilyalsa Shabazz, on the 100th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Podcaster, documentary filmmaker, and professional blurred. Fan of democracy and OG hater of fascism and apartheid. Joy-Ann Reid is best known as an American political commentator and television host. She was a national correspondent for MSNBC and is best known for hosting the political commentary program, The Readout, from 2020 to 2025. Her previous anchoring credits include The Reid Report from 2014 to 2015 and AM Joy from 2016 to 2020. Fresh on the heels of her panel discussion at the Journalism Under Fire, Guarding Against Threats to Our Democracy fireside chat that took place in Washington, D.C., we have one of the greatest defenders of democracy, advocates for marginalized people, and one of the brightest political minds of our time, the one and only Joy-Ann Reid. This is the Black Information Network Daily Podcast. I am your host, Ramses Ja.
And I am your host, Q Ward.
All right, Joy-Ann Reid. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing better now after that introduction. I need to take y'all with me everywhere I go.
Listen, man, we get on the stage. We'll make you. We'll let the people know exactly who they got coming up. So you know, we wouldn't be mad at that at all. Listen, I want to say our listeners know this, but I want to make sure that I say it to you that you are more than the introduction. You are more than. You know, what you represent and the work that you do really does matter. And I'm at a loss for words. it's a very, very special episode to be recording with you. You know, we've kind of been in similar circles over the years and, you know, tried to get a word to you, but we understand and respect the work that you're doing. And when the time is right, you know, maybe we'll get a chance to have a conversation with you. And today is that day. So this is kind of like, you know, all of our stars in alignment and 10 Christmases at once. So so welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's good to be here.
All right. Absolutely. All right. So first off, talk to us a little bit about the fireside chat that I mentioned, because that's kind of been the big deal in the news. So this took place at the Journalism Under Fire event. For people that weren't able to attend or people that might have heard about it and been curious about it, talk to us about, you know, what took place and maybe what people should know, what the people that attended might have learned from that event.
Well, I mean, this was an important conversation. Of course, Nicole Hannah-Jones being one of the most seminal and important figures in modern journalistic history. I mean, obviously, her creation of the 1619 Project blew up the world, broke the brains of the entire American right, set Christopher Rufo and others off on a tear to try to destroy diversity, equity, and inclusion and their version of critical race theory, which they didn't even clearly understand. But I think what's happened now is that, particularly after the election for the second time of Donald Trump, is that you have a real aggressive Project 2025 driven right-wing Christian nationalist-driven war on everything from journalism to basic freedom to immigration to potentially birthright citizenship, you name it, it's all being torn apart. And this particular gathering was to really talk about the journalism piece and how in each of these three instances, there was a woman from the Los Angeles Times who actually left there because the owner of the LA Times has decided to turn that seminal, you know, really august paper into a mouthpiece for Donald Trump and to suppress anti-Trump views at the paper, all the way to Robert Kagan, who is a conservative who used to write for The Washington Post until he resigned because of Jeff Bezos' takeover of the paper and his attempt to root out anti-Trump views or critical views of Donald Trump. Although I have to say that there are still people that are writing critically about Donald Trump at the Washington Post, but he's warped the mission, right? He even got rid of Democracy Dies in Darkness and said now they're now going to be about individual liberty or something like that, some neoliberal, you know, economic principle. And so that's happening everywhere. And of course, you know, I like to quote the Friday thing. I don't know how you're going to get fired on your day off, but I did get fired on my day off.
I remember that.
Like Friday, but, you know, and, you know, I was never told why I was, and I said this on stage, I was never given a reason why I was let go and why my show was canceled and why more than 100 really experienced, longtime staffers of MSNBC producers were essentially thrown out of their jobs and forced to reapply, doged. But I can take a guess, you know. I don't think it helped my case that I've been a very firm supporter of DEI, of diversity, equity, and inclusion, that I've been a very firm believer that Donald Trump is a fascist, that as his former chief of staff and Mark Milley, his former joint chiefs of staff chair, they both said he's a fascist to the core. That's their view, not mine. His own vice president has said he may be America's Hitler. Then he became his vice president. You name it. It's clear that he has fascist instincts and he's married himself to a group of white Christian nationalists who are very clearly trying to move the country into fascism and Christian nationalism. So saying that is probably not helpful. Also probably not helpful that I was pretty firm that, you know, it's probably suboptimal for the United States to be arming Israel with 2,000-pound bombs to drop on Palestinians at school and in their apartments and destroying mosques and everything else. So, yeah, I can take a good guess.
Unfortunately, I think we can all take a good guess. With all the major shakeups that we are all collectively witnessing in the media landscape since Trump's reelection, what are some concerns that you have about the state of journalism in the United States?
I'm very concerned, honestly. The resignation recently, we also talked about this at the forum, of the some 35-year leader of 60 Minutes, head of 60 Minutes, Bob Owens. That was alarming. And he resigned very clearly saying that he was leaving because he felt that he no longer had the editorial independence to cover the news without fear or favor the way that 60 Minutes has done since I was, you know, I've been watching it since I was in junior high school. And it has not changed. It's very tough on any president. It's not partisan in any way. But, you know, they recently did a really important, I think, report about the 235 men, and we think some women, who were shipped to El Salvador into a prison, into a gulag, without any due process, and that 75% of them have no criminal record anywhere. And highlighting the cases of people like Kilmar Brego Garcia, who was literally renditioned out of the United States, out of Maryland, without due process. And they did a really critical story on that. They've also done really important reporting on the war in Gaza and on the human rights violations therein and on the allegations of genocide therein. And they were in a lawsuit with Donald Trump because he claimed that their interview with Vice President Kamala Harris, which is a perfectly normal interview for a presidential candidate, was somehow biased. And he's sicked the FCC on not just CBS, but also on ABC because he doesn't like the coverage of himself on ABC, on Comcast, my former employer, because he doesn't like the coverage from MSNBC or the financial, accurate financial coverage, I suppose, from CNBC, which is talking about his failures on the economy. You name it, the media is under fire. And I think when you see people like Jeff Bezos, who is not a journalist, interfering in the way that the Washington Post does what it was designed to do, when you see the owner of the Los Angeles Times bending the knee to Trump and essentially requiring his editorial page to do the same, and then when you're also seeing a takeover of even a lot of local TV stations by organizations like the Sinclair Media Group, which is a right-wing Fox-style organization and entity that's now taking over your traffic and weather together and replacing political news with what amounts to conservative, conservative ideas and ideation, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. We can't have a free society if we don't have a free press. And there's an attack on the free press unlike anything I've ever seen. And that, to me, I can't liken to anything other than the McCarthy era.
You know, what's interesting about that is that working in this space, we pay particular attention to the same things that you're mentioning now. And, you know, our listeners, our viewers around the country, they often remind us to be encouraged, to keep going. Our voices are more important now than ever. And you realize that how important that infrastructure is. You mentioned the Sinclair Media Group. You mentioned the Washington Post, you know, and who owns that infrastructure is critically important now. And we've leaned further into our relationship with like Real Times Media, a lot of like black owned newspapers around the country, because, you know, as source material, but also as partners in ensuring that we are strengthened and that they are strengthened, because you realize how vulnerable you are when there's a shift and the power is concentrated into the hands of just a few people. And so this is kind of an interesting development, but we only have one story to tell, and it's our story, and it's the truth. And so, you know, I commend you on not only enduring, but maintaining and, you know, having these important conversations. And that, you know, that brings me to the next thing that I wanted to ask you about, because I heard about the State of the People tour. So for folks that don't know, myself included, talk to us about the State of the People tour, and make sure you give the website too, especially for our listeners that are kind of interested in staying plugged into something that is a little bit more accurate, a little less biased.
Yeah, and I'll just to your previous point, I want to, mm-hmm. Note that, Ida B. Wells was operating as an independent black woman journalist at a time when the media was essentially controlled by two men, including William Randolph Hearst. And when the white media refused to report on lynchings in any other way than to say that the dead man, woman, or child that was lynched committed a crime, with there was, again, no due process. So there's a history of this. And you know, it is really critical, you know, now more than ever, that we strengthen, you know, there are thousands of black, independent black newspapers, but they are, you know, withering away in terms of support from the public. And then our access to, you know, being able to have a wider audience, as you all are able to do through syndication, that also is in many ways dependent on corporate America, right? And if you look at the place where our creators, black creators, have had the most access, it's been through social media. It's been through YouTube and TikTok and Instagram. And companies like Meta are also bending the knee to Trump, gave $1 million to the inauguration. You know, TikTok suddenly put out a blast to every single person who owns TikTok and uses it in the United States, glorifying Donald Trump for not following the Supreme Court order to make them be sold, right? And for supposedly saving TikTok when he's the one who created the crisis in the first place. Yeah. So you're seeing the social media, you know, there used to be a thing called Black Twitter. Black Twitter is what built Twitter. Twitter would have been nothing without black people making it popular. And yet black people own none of that IP. The content was not owned by anyone. They were just giving that content to previously Jack and then Elon Musk for free. So we really have to be cognizant, I think, as a people of not only where we're getting our information, how to avoid disinformation, and how to share information amongst ourselves in a way that can be authentic, which brings me to the State of the People tour. on the night of the, it wasn't really a State of the Union. It was technically a joint address to Congress that Donald Trump gave in February. There were a group of us who are a combination of activists, you know, and people like Angela Rye, who used to be the chief counsel to the Congressional Black Caucus, and who's now a podcaster and activist in her own right. Lolo Smith, there are a bunch of people, the Advancement Project, you know, Rashad Robinson, formerly of Color of Change, just a bunch of us decided that we were going to do a 24-hour live stream across all our platforms. So I co-host a podcast called Read This, Read That. We streamed it on the Read This, Read That YouTube channel. It was streamed on, you know, Mark Thompson's channel. And all of us just live streamed together 24 hours of content in which we, as Black creators and activists and speakers and media people, all came together. And by the way, these were Black folk who generally had never worked together before. Some of us didn't even know each other personally. Mm-hmm. But you know how you know, white people assume all Black people know each other?
Yeah.
We all know each other.
Okay.
We have to, right? And all so we all came together, people who didn't even really know each other, had never worked with each other before, live streamed 24 hours of content in which we just talked among ourselves about what we need in our community, about what the state of the union is for us.
Okay.
And so out of that came this idea that we needed to take that live stream that over a million people watched on these collective, all common channels, YouTube, Instagram, et cetera, and decided to take that on the road. So the State of the People tour, it was a very fast put together by Angela and some other folks. And the idea of it is to go into 10 communities, really 12, because Raleigh and Durham are two different places, Birmingham and Montgomery, both in Alabama, but 10 very heavily Black cities, Detroit, New Orleans, Newark, New Jersey, Los Angeles, California, Durham, you know, sort of all over the country, and go and do two things. Number one, find out what people need. Because one of the things that I think is generally a problem is that a lot of us do a lot of talking about what people should do and not a lot of asking what people want.
They should. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so I think for our community, and a lot of people didn't vote, but a lot of people didn't vote mostly because they didn't know the issues, weren't paying attention, weren't really read in, and really weren't sure that voting does anything for them. Even voting for Obama, it doesn't feel like it did anything for them. So going in and saying, hey, register to vote, or, you know, that's not going to help anymore. We need to just ask people what they want, ask people what they need, what would make their lives better, provide services, offer assistance where we can. And then the second piece is to rally people's spirits, because HIT Strategies, which is a really terrific Black-owned polling firm, did some really scary data after the 2024 election that found that Black Americans have not felt this disempowered for a generation. We are seeing generational sense of disempowerment among Black people after the failure of Kamala Harris to win.
Yeah.
So we need to reverse that by letting people feel empowered, feel community, feel a sense of community, and also to do these field hearings to find out what people need and what they want. So we're going to 12 cities. We started in Atlanta and started by delivering food to seniors and then rallied folks together and had a bunch of smaller group conversations, including a land giveaway, you name it. And we're going to take that on the road. And so that's what the State of the People tour is. And you can register for your city and find out what cities we're coming to. And you can do that at stateofthepppl.com, stateofthepppl.com. And that's also on Instagram and TikTok.
Rams and I have to figure out how to get to one of these cities, because that definitely sounds like something that we'd like to be a part of and support you in any way that we can.
That would be great.
You kind of touched on some of this already, so I want to kind of bring it back to you. Trump is dominating headlines with several different initiatives that, like, muzzle velocity. Just there's something every day. Rams and I were discussing how everything seems to be aimed at tearing some group of people down. He's not proposing anything that seems to help anyone, but all of these initiatives that he's so happy to do his photo op with seem to be targeted at some group and tearing these particular groups down. As you were speaking to how Black people feel so disempowered and kind of hopeless, what are some things that we, one, should be paying attention to? And what are some things that we can kind of grab a hold to so we don't feel so hopeless and so disempowered? Like, there's nothing that we can do but just accept this new state that we're in. And that is a really, as you could imagine, difficult thing for even us collectively to do in the space that we work in. But for those who are even less connected and less informed than we are, what are some things that we can share or say to people?
Yeah, and you know, Q, the thing that's so, you know, sort of frustrating for, you know, just watching it happen is that when you are attacking everything, as you said, everywhere all at once, and people are also just concerned about economic survival, right? Because for a lot of folks, thing one is how he's destroying the economy and their opportunity to just be able to pay their bills and afford food, right? That's number one. I mean, attacking the economy, that, you know, you can love or hate Joe Biden, okay? And a lot of people don't like him, but the economy was stable and was growing and actually was the best economy in the West after and during COVID. But I think people didn't feel it in a lot of ways. And so they rolled the dice thinking that Trump would improve the economy. A lot of us that voted for him. And now they're finding that they're just getting destroyed. Food prices are going through the roof. Gas prices are up. It's all going in the wrong direction. And it's making it hard for people to live. So I think the main thing that people are paying attention to is just how hard he's making it to live. And when you're feeling economically unstable, it's very difficult to have the strength and the time on your hands and the will to fight everything else. So the challenge is, number one, we need to start focusing on how to get resources into our communities to make sure our people are not hungry, are not evicted, don't lose their health care, like focusing on those local issues to keep our people alive. Frankly, in this moment, I think that's number one, because you can't focus on everything, right? We can't stop him from doing everything, but we need to really start thinking locally and thinking in community terms. How do we keep people in our communities alive and in their homes with a roof over their heads and food on the table? That's number one. And then I think the second piece is, if you do have the capacity to broaden out and do more, the things that he's attacking that in the end are really going to affect us. Number one, this attempt to attack birthright citizenship. Know that that's, you know, I'm a daughter of immigrants, so that definitely affects if you're a first generation immigrant, right? Or if you're an immigrant yourself. But it also affects if you're an African American, because the only reason Black folks have citizenship at all is the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. Because after, you know, during enslavement, Black people were not considered citizens of the United States. The Dred Scott case said that Black people were not citizens and had no rights that whites were bound to respect. It was the 14th Amendment that made Black people citizens. If you undermine the 14th Amendment, there's almost nothing you can't do to us. This man has already, his administration, his regime, as I call it, has already deported American citizens. That's a thing that's already happened, including American citizen children, one with cancer, a 7-year-old. So they've already done that. And they've done it to brown people, but we know that they always get to us eventually. So we actually have to start paying attention. As angry as a lot of Black folks are with the brown people who voted for Trump, you need to watch that. Because we're on the list. Whatever they do to them, they're eventually going to want to do to us. Now, can they deport? Where are they going to deport us to? I don't know, Mississippi, right? Like, you figure you can't. But they're not deporting people to where they come from. They're deporting people to a foreign prison that we're paying to take them. And Donald Trump said on an open mic to Nayib Bukele, who is the president of El Salvador and calls himself the world's most popular dictator, Trump said to him, the homegrowns are next.
Yeah.
Homegrowns are next. What does that mean? I don't know. Maybe it means they're going to try to find some first generation brown people and send them to prison. Or maybe that means anyone in a disfavored group. And there's no group more disfavored than us. Yeah. So I think we need to really pay attention to that. I think the third thing, as much as voting doesn't solve everything, this SAVE Act is a problem. Because if they pass it, it's going to make it much harder for us to vote. They're building things into that bill that are designed to make it harder for women and people of color to vote. I just got off this morning a Public Religion Research Institute presentation of their latest polling. It's one of the largest polling organizations in the country. They polled 5,000 people. It's a big sample poll with a 1.7% margin of error. White evangelical Christians stand alone in fervently favoring everything Donald Trump, Doge, and Elon Musk are doing, including them taking our data. They stand in favor of having concentration camps in America to put, quote unquote, illegal immigrants in. They believe in white replacement theory by a majority. and they believe that it is white Christians who are being discriminated against, not anyone else. And so they want to end any programs that favor people of color. This attack that feels like it may be on somebody else is on us. So unfortunately, if we have the bandwidth beyond saving ourselves and saving our communities from economic harm immediately, we do need to start thinking about what this man is doing to undermine the democracy, because we got nowhere else to go but here and potentially to a foreign prison.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's that's I was watching something that kind of spoke to that dynamic in, you know, middle America, we'll call them, like, you know, those reliably red states, you know, God's country or however you want to call it. And you're right. Those people are the most likely to believe conspiracy theories. They're the most likely to support Donald Trump and whatever he does, giving him the powers of a king, essentially. They're the most likely to be racist. They're the most likely to consume propaganda. They're the most likely, you know, there's a whole list. And they fail on all of these, like, critical, headings, you know, underneath all these critical elements that are important to a reasonably informed voter base. They're the most likely to ignore harms, things that will harm their own communities and shape their own outcomes negatively, in order to what they feel is protect their long-term interests, and their long-term interests in their minds align with those of exceptionally wealthy white Christian men who were born healthy and straight. And so, you know, that's a problem that we've found. But often when we try to engage, you know, people that feel that way, there's a pushback. And the pushback is that, well, look, these people are not racist. They're not racist. They just want everything fair. They don't believe in white privilege. What is white privilege? They just cannot conceptualize that they were born with anything extra. And one of the things that we try to say, and I'd love to get your thoughts on just kind of this whole group of people, as it relates to people who try to engage and people that try to inform them. One of the things that we say is white privilege is being able to be, you know, born and run your race from the starting line. If you get to start with zero, that's white privilege. You know, right. Anything else is being born with a strike against you, essentially, and you have to work a little harder. You may have some hurdles on your lap where, you know, a person who's born that straight Christian, healthy, white man gets to just run a fair race. And if we catch up to you, I think that kind of attacks your concept of white superiority. It must be buried somewhere in your head. Please share your thoughts on, you know, how challenging this has been to engage this community, or maybe some strategies, you know, or ways around it, perhaps.
Okay, so, you know, I would say that for those who believe in their own mind, and I think that most people who are MAGA, who support Donald Trump, they don't think of themselves as racist.
Yeah, yeah.
And would be quite offended, mm-hmm, by the idea that anyone thinks they're racist. And what they'll often say is, as you did, they just want everything to be fair. But what the data shows, including this new data, the Pew Research data, the PRI data, you name it, is that only white Americans agree in a majority with the following statement: discrimination against white people and discrimination against white Christians is as bad as discrimination is against other people. No other group agrees with that. They're the only group that views discrimination, in their mind, against white people and discrimination, I should say, against Christians generally. So discrimination against Christians and discrimination against whites is as bad as it's been against other people. In a country where black people were enslaved, mm-hmm, where there was an Asian Exclusion Act, where non-white immigrants were banned from the country in the 1920s, and could not get jobs. There were signs held up that used to say no Jews, no Cubans, no blacks. There have never been signs in America that say no whites, no Christians. And yet only white people, white Christians, not even just all whites, but white Christians, because white unaligned folks don't agree with this. White Christians are alone in the polling in a majority. And I'm talking about 2/3 of them believe that there is rampant discrimination against white people and against Christians. And also only white evangelicals, white Mormons, white Catholics, white Christians in general, in a majority believe, right, that Donald Trump should be given all the powers he needs in order to set the country right, and that diversity programs and that diversity in general is more harmful than helpful to the country. There is no other group that believes that. So what I would challenge white Americans to do is ask yourself, why do only white people believe that? So, and back off from the question of whether you yourself are racist as a white person. Can you explain why white Americans are alone in these belief systems? Why no other group sees it? This sense of victimization, the sense that white people are being victimized by immigration, victimized by diversity, equity, and inclusion, and also that elections are being stolen from them. No other group agrees with that. No other group. They're the only ones. If white Americans went into, were beamed up into space, like, you know, Scotty beamed them up to the Enterprise, and they were off the Earth, no Republican would ever be elected in the United States again, because only white Americans vote in a majority for Republicans. Yeah. They should ask themselves why every other group is over here and they're over here. Something's going on, and you can't find any other factor. Sorry, this is my dog. You can't find any other factor that is relevant when you peel away all the other factors, economic condition, educational attainment. No other factor explains it but race. And all of the islands that white Christians exist on ideologically, you can't align them with anything else. Income, region, age. Race is the only one in which they all align. So I would just challenge people who are white to ask themselves why that is. If it is not about a sense that white people guard their superior condition in the original Constitution and believe that this country was created for white Christians.
You know, we often find when trying to have these types of conversations that we are not dealing with the same facts. We are not living in the same reality, which becomes the non-starter. Like right at the beginning of the conversation, we realize, okay, the facts and the truth cannot be two-sided. There's no two sets of facts that mean the same thing. There are no two realities or two truths. But as you just explained, when dealing with people, especially specifically MAGA Trump supporters, who I think identify a piece of themselves in him, so they end up defending themselves while trying to defend him. Joya, how do we have these conversations when we can't start from the same place? What are some tools that we can use to even try for our neighbors, for family members at Thanksgiving, for, you know, those who just are contrarian in nature? Mm-hmm. What are some starting points to try to get us at least back to the same set of facts and living in the same reality?
I think part of the problem is you it's hard to do that because, as I have observed Trumpism, I no longer view it as a political ideology. I view it as essentially a religion. A religion that has in many ways replaced traditional Christianity and become a version, a sect of Christianity. Mm-hmm. Because again, white Catholics, evangelicals, Protestants, and people who are Latter-day Saints all line up together on one side for the party that is against immigration, against feeding the poor, against helping the sick,
everything Jesus stood for.
Correct. If you just listen to the red letters in the Bible, it states that and actually the Pope who just died, Pope Francis, his last speech, his last, you know, encyclicals to his public was that we must care for the immigrant and the poor. He named himself Francis after St. Francis of Assisi, the patron of the poor, patron saint of the poor. There's never been a previous Pope Francis, and there's a reason for that. That no Pope, you know, in their gilded, you know, fancy, you know, silk slippers wanted to be associated with, you know, St. Francis until him. And he said, he would say, I am of the poor and the poor are me. I am of them, right? And Christians in America, evangelical Christians, disagree with that. They disagree with the red letters of Jesus. So what I tend to think is it's a religion. I couldn't talk someone out of being a Buddhist if I tried, and I wouldn't try. So I don't try to talk people out of megaism because I think it's a religion, and I can't talk people out of their religion. But what I do think that is useful when you're talking to people who are aligned with him is just ask them some very simple questions and ask and keep asking and drilling into the facts they think are true. When they say tariffs are going to make the economy better, say why? How? Well, because the foreign government's going to pay them. Really? Because when the importer brings them in, the importer has to pay those tariffs, right? How does the country get involved in that, that sent them, that they're not involved? And just keep making them justify what they're doing. I think at a certain point, you see a lot of these people do this on TikTok where they try to get MAGA people to explain the things they believe.
Yeah.
And they generally can't. They can't support it. Just and let them try and see if that breaks the spell.
We are here today with American political commentator, best-selling author, and television host, Joy Ann Reid. Okay, so I recognize and have for some time that, you know, we're in a challenging place. But there's this sense of, what should we focus on? What first? What's the most important thing? You know, obviously, we've talked about Donald Trump himself and the strategy of his regime. I like that word. We've talked about white evangelicals and how they feel as though the country is being taken from them specifically and that they are being treated unfairly. We've talked about, we've touched on, you know, maybe the strategies that Democrats should, you know, consider, you know, using. I know that you're doing it with the tour, but, you know, it's not inconceivable to see Democrats implementing something similar, just asking people, what do you want? You know, this conversation obviously is a lot bigger than today's episode, but I think that, you know, just coming from your mind and your vantage point, this question could certainly, at minimum, be interesting, you know, to get your response. But for a lot of people, it could, you know, give them a sense of, okay, here's what we should be focusing on. So I'll ask, if you had a magic wand and you could make an instant change to, I'm not going to ask about the country because obviously I think I know what that answer would be. But if you could make an instant change, let's say to the Democratic Party, what would you change about the Democratic Party that you think would lead to better outcomes, not just for Democrats, but for the country?
Ooh, that's a long conversation.
I'm sorry.
Having worked in Democratic campaign politics, I think the Democratic Party has a lot of problems.
Sure.
And I would point to, I'll just point to two that I think are really big. I think one of them is Democrats' general refusal to embrace the base they have rather than coveting the base Republicans have. Mm. I think in general, my experience with the Democratic Party is that their base is multiracial. It's heavily Black. Democrats really rely on Black voters and on brown voters, but they really want white voters. Mm. they really, really want white working class voters back. And that has caused them to fixate on those voters almost to the exclusion of everyone else.
Sure.
And to make assumptions about Black and Brown and young voters and AAPI voters that are not supported by evidence. They just assume the Blacks will come out and vote.
Especially for Kamala, yeah.
Correct. And so, percentage-wise, they will. But there's also a third person always in every race, and it's called the couch. And in this race, millions of us chose the couch. Millions of young voters chose the couch. 30% of Americans voted for Kamala Harris. 31% voted for Donald Trump. The rest voted for the couch. That's a problem.
Yeah.
The PRI poll showed that a third of the voters who chose not to vote in the last election now regret their vote. And a majority of those who did not vote in the last election, this is across all races, and who regret their vote, about 70% of them believe Donald Trump is a dictator. Mm. So there is a pool of voters out there who you could pull off the couch if you would just focus on them and ask them for their votes. The second issue I have with the Democratic Party is that they are also very married to neoliberal economics. You hear Democrats talk a lot about the middle class, the middle class, the middle class, the middle class. The middle class is shrinking. A lot of their voters are not middle class. They're barely middle class, working class, or poor.
Yeah.
Democrats ignore them completely. They don't talk about them. They only talk about this mythical middle class.
Yeah.
And they focus their economic ideas on this mythical middle class. College educated people whose kids go to college, people who themselves went to college or have PhDs, the people who watch MSNBC. Mm-hmm. That is a part of the electorate, but in America, only about at maximum 40% of Americans have college degrees, and that's only in about 22 states. In the rest of the states, fewer than 30% of Americans have college degrees. College attainment is not a majority position.
Yeah. If I may, I want to make sure that I interject this, and Q, don't let me jump in front of you, but I heard something said recently. I think the gentleman's name is Dr. Roy Casagrande, if I'm not mistaken, that's his name. But he said something that was so potent, and he said that the difference between middle class and poor is essentially it's just stable housing. And mm-hmm. so I think it's important to kind of help illuminate the point that you're making. In terms of how the middle class is shrinking and what we would typically conceive of as middle class, that is very much a myth nowadays. And so, yeah, I think you're right. For folks to hyperfixate on the mythical middle class ignores the reality of our current predicament. And they're playing politics as usual. And this is not the state of play anymore. So continue.
Absolutely. No. And you're absolutely right in that if you only focus on the middle class and suburban college educated voters and you're going for the suburbs, well, the poor and the working class include rural people. Not all of them are white. Mm-hmm. That includes people who, as you said, have unstable housing. That includes people who are one paycheck away from poverty, people who are using payday loans to pay for groceries, which is an increasing phenomenon. Democrats don't talk about that. They don't talk like that. You know who talks about the working class? Republicans. Mm. And they don't even care about the working class. They could give a damn. They only care about the super rich. But they talk like they care about the working class. And the third thing I would say about Democrats that is a problem, if we had to have three big diagnoses, it is their fervent defense of the system. Democrats are systems people. And they insist that what we must do is defend democracy, defend the system. Well, the system doesn't work for a lot of people. And so when you're a person defending the system, you're essentially rejecting people in your own base who think the system is failing and who voting for even Barack Obama did nothing for them. They didn't get anything materially from it. Whereas when Donald Trump got elected, in their mind, they got a check.
Yeah.
Even though the check was from Nancy Pelosi, but the Democrats weren't smart enough to put
it. Donald Trump put his name on the check, too. Yeah, so
they think Trump is a check. They think Trump equals checks. I remember having a conversation with a United States senatorial candidate who said, well, what should I be saying? And I said, cut all the rest of your speech out and just say checks. Yeah. Just say checks.
Works.
That's what people need.
You spoke about college educated. And immediately what popped into my head was the dismantling of the Department of Education. The other side trying to rewrite or erase our history. and major institutions of higher learning kind of bending the knee preemptively to the wishes of this administration and the newly reelected president. Your alma mater, however, made the news for some different reasons recently. As a Harvard graduate, tell us a little bit about your thoughts of Harvard to just not bow to that pressure that the Trump administration is kind of blanketing all institutions of higher learning with.
I was very pleasantly surprised. I was very proud of Harvard, and I haven't said that very often since I graduated in 1991. Harvard, you know, I took Ec 10 at Harvard. Harvard is not a liberal institution. The idea it's liberal is kind of ridiculous. It's full of very rich people. Legacies are about 43% of the of the admittees who just get there because their granddaddy went there and they're super rich and they have named, some of the buildings are named after them. Harvard teaches neoliberal economics and nothing else. They teach against equity and inclusion. They're just not liberal. But in this case, they are 140 years older than the United States, and they have a $53 billion endowment, and they're not going to be told what to do by a mere president of the United States, who in their mind is an ephemeral figure who will be out in 4 years, or maybe eight, or maybe 12, or until he dies.
Or he'll die, yeah.
So I'm proud of Harvard, and I wish more institutions. I think Columbia was the opposite, an abject failure. Yeah. Didn't defend their students who are being deported without due process, didn't defend democracy. And have, you know, bent the knee. So I'm hoping that Harvard and also the Big Ten, I'll give the Big Ten colleges their due, that they're standing up to him. I think any way that people are standing up to Trump in large ways or small, big ups to Jalen Hurts. I'm about to be an Eagles fan for life now because
that way.
That wasn't even my team, but he's like, yeah, I got other things to do than to go stand around with Donald Trump, you know, and
oh, God.
Other ones can do that. I'm not doing that.
Yeah, yeah, I like that.
Concur.
Hey, I'm with that. I like that.
Absolutely.
I know that we're short on time, but I wanted to make sure that we ask you about this because, you know, you've had a lot to say about, you know, the boycotting of Target and, you know, just the resistance. You know, we talked about obviously Harvard and the Big Ten, and I applaud them as well, them getting together and figuring out ways to resist Donald Trump. But us as people, as individuals who can choose to shop here or to shop there. You know, talk to us about maybe and talk to our listeners, I should say, about maybe the long term strategy of boycotts and how you see them as having the potential to shape political outcomes.
Yeah, what I would say is that, you know, I'm a student of the apartheid movement in South Africa. And the way that eventually South Africans, black South Africans, broke apartheid was through general strikes. It was by making the country ungovernable and economically unsound. And that was through a combination of encouraging divestment and boycott externally and using general strikes and economic resistance internally. And that is the way you ultimately can break autocracy. And in our country, I just wrote a book about Medgar Evers and Merle Evers Williams. And one of the ways that Medgar fought against autocracy here was to encourage people to use boycotts and to use boycotts to break the autocracy in Mississippi. And what he would say is that not everyone has got the capacity to march or has got the courage to march or has got the courage to engage in civic activism because it's risky to go out there and put yourself in the, you know, view of the police and the authorities. But everyone can do a little something. He launched his boycott against the Jackson retailers who would not respect black customers by saying, and he launched it during Easter. And he said, rather than go and buy your new Easter outfit this year, maybe make an outfit or wear what you wore last year. Just refuse to shop when you're not respected. And I believe that Megger was right. I would not set foot in a store that treated me with disrespect. And Harvard treated our community with disrespect. They don't deserve our dollars. Walmart did the same thing. All of these companies, Amazon, Jeff Bezos, these companies that have said, we don't want diversity, then fine. You don't have to have diversity in your customers either.
Ooh. So
that is, to me, the small thing we can each do. We can just choose to shop elsewhere, choose not to hand our money to people who would bow down to a wannabe dictator. If you can just do that little thing, you are already doing the activism that's possible for you. And you are already doing something heroic for yourself, your community, your dignity, and your country.
Joanne Reed, we already expressed to you that you are literally a superhero to us. Our listeners, we assume, and I'm not even assuming, I know how they feel, are going to be just as excited to hear your voice as we are to be having this conversation with you. Catch us all up on what's next for you, how we can keep up with you, social media, websites, whatever that is. Because I was talking to a great friend of ours, Jamel Hill, who loves you to life. And we just all want to be able to show up for you specifically in this moment and moving forward in the best way that we can. So how do we support you? How do we keep up with you? Besides Ramses and I crashing this tour and showing up to give you a hug, how can we all collectively be a part of the Joanne Reed movement?
Well, I appreciate that. You know, Jamel Hill, that's my girl. That is my machete sister and vacation buddy. So absolutely love her, and big ups to Jamel, who is fighting the good fight in a tough atmosphere. She did that at ESPN, which is a rough atmosphere.
Yes, indeed.
and won and beat them at their own game. I keep it real simple. Pretty much everything that I do is at Joanne Reed. So I am at Joanne Reed on Instagram. I am at Joanne Reed on Threads. I'm at Joanne Reed on Blue Sky. And my Substack is joannereed.com. All right. The only place it's a little bit different is on TikTok and Facebook. I'm Joy Reed Official. And if you subscribe to me on joyannereed.com, I do not charge for subscriptions. You can just subscribe for free. The only people that I charge a fee to is if you want to comment to me, because if you're going to troll me, you're going to have to put some coins in the bucket. So if you want to be a commenter, you got to pay.
Absolutely.
But that is free. I don't believe in paywalls. You guys can just subscribe to my Substack on joyannereed.com. I try to post every day some kind of thought or thing, and I will also be announcing there. And of course, on Read This, Read That, my podcast with Jackie Reed, my soror sister, cousin, friend. And I will be letting folks know on those two forums when my new show, which is going to be called The Joy Reed Show, will be launching. So I am launching a new show.
Yes, Lord.
Find out when. I'm giving y'all the little sneak peek preview on this podcast.
Okay.
But the show is going to launch very soon, and I'm going to make the announcement on joyannereed.com. And on Read This, Read That.
Well, listen, we will take it, because as I mentioned, as Q mentioned, you know, you are like, you know, that North Star. We've had to piece together our journey as activists and as, you know, talk radio personalities. As I mentioned, you know, we're DJs. We give away Cardi B tickets and Migos tickets. That's what we do. And so, you know, stepping into this space because the work is necessary. We felt the work was necessary. Especially in hip hop radio stations around the country, not having a blueprint is kind of scary, and it's kind of intimidating. And knowing that you're there consistently showing us things that we need to see, providing perspective, giving us ways to challenge, you know, the pushback that we receive as we travel around the country. Of course, as we host our program and we have listeners interact, it's been the people that tell us to keep going because the work we do matters, you know, that's us now saying that to you, because if it had not been for you, there's so many times we would have been more lost than we were. And absolutely because of you, we were able to find our way more than once. And we will continue to watch you to watch you shine and support you however we can, as Q mentioned. So with that in mind, I'd like to say thank you again very much for taking the time to come here and talk to us, to share your insight with us, your brilliance with us, and to obviously to make an announcement on your forthcoming show and how people can stay in touch with you and hopefully become fans of you if they haven't been before, in the same way that we are. So once again, today's guest is American political commentator, bestselling author, and television host, Joanne Reed.
Ramses and Q, thank you all very much. Look, as an old hip hop head, first of all, I would take those Cardi B tickets if you want to get look, my theme song when I graduated from Harvard, well, me and my best friend Shotzi, who unfortunately passed since then, our theme song was "Can I Kick It?" Yes, you can.
Yes, you can.
You tip in a Trial Called Quest. So I'm an OG hip hop fan. So I appreciate y'all. And it's always great to be with fellow hip hop fans. I appreciate you.
This has been a production of the Black Information Network. Today's show was produced by Chris Thompson. Have some thoughts you'd like to share? I am your host, Ramses Ja, on all social media.
I am Q Ward on all social media as well.
Later this month, we will celebrate the 100th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm Little, also known as El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz or Malcolm X. The civil rights leader we lost too soon is the subject of a new book by my next guest, Dr. Ibram X. Kendi. Dr. Kendi, thank you for joining us.
Of course.
The book is called Malcolm Lives, the official biography of Malcolm X for young readers. Why did you feel this was a book that needed to be written for a young generation today?
Well, there are a lot of people around the world who read the autobiography of Malcolm X when they were in high school or college or even older.
I was in elementary school when it came out. I remember reading.
Yeah, and it really transformed them. It allowed them to really see racism squarely. It allowed them to see how they can combat racism. So why can't our young people be learning about Brother Malcolm when they're in elementary school or even middle school and they become transformed then? That was one of the reasons why I wanted to do this book.
Now, you write about the one and only meeting between Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm in 1964. And America has sanitized King's legacy. Me coming out of the King movement, I feel they've sanitized it too much, but that's my opinion. But it still portrays Malcolm, who championed self-defense, as a militant, a scary one, contrasting Dr. King. I was 10 years old when Malcolm was assassinated. I was 12 or 13 when Martin was assassinated. But I grew up very close to their widows, Dr. Betty Shabazz and Coretta Scott King. Dr. Shabazz was the godmother of my two daughters. How does the book unpack some of the myths around around Malcolm's legacy?
Well, as a biographer, I wanted to tell the truth, the complicated and even complex truth, obviously in an age-appropriate way. And so I think young people learn that Malcolm was about self-defense. He wasn't this violent militant who was trying to raise armies. They find that he had an ideological evolution. After he came back from Mecca, he spoke about all people as being racially equal, and of course was really focused on elevating the struggle for civil rights to human rights. And so I show his story in all of its fullness.
Now, you worked with Malcolm X and stayed on the novel, on this novel, and included some amazing primary sources such as pictures and letters that Malcolm typed out himself.
Yes.
They tell the story of his journey from ex-con to leader of a movement. What do you want young readers to take away from that?
That they can transform this world. That no matter what station that they're in, you know, Malcolm suffered his father being killed, his mother being taken away, detention homes, poverty, hunger, incarceration, but he still became one of the greatest American revolutionaries in history, transformed the world. We're still talking about him. So every young people, no matter who they are, where they are, they can still become somebody who's going to greatly influence this world.
My mother used to tell me, it's Mother's Day, it's not where you come from, it's where you're going.
Exactly.
Malcolm was 39 when he was killed, right as he was transforming his stances and ideology. What did we miss out on? What was lost if we never saw Malcolm at 40? We never saw Dr. King at 40. He got killed at 39. Medgar Evers at 39. But since you're focusing on this book, Malcolm at 39, what do you think we lost if Malcolm had lived to an older age?
Well, as you know, one of his last campaigns was to get the United States before the United States nations being charged with violating the human rights of African Americans. And the way he went about doing that was really trying to bring together the black world, trying to ensure that African Americans and continental Africans saw themselves as one people who are commonly subjected to global white supremacy. He wasn't able to ultimately, you know, achieve that, but if he lived, there could actually be more unity throughout the black world, you know, if he would have lived.
Now, I want to get your take on Trump's firing of congressional librarian, Dr. Carla Hayden, appointed by President Obama. She was the first woman, the first black person, and the first librarian who did not get a lifetime appointment to run the Library of Congress. There was only 1 year left on her 10-year term. But conservatives recently accused her of pushing so-called radical children's books. As the author of a book for young adults, I'm sure many conservatives will object to. What are your thoughts about the way they've targeted books and education in their culture wars?
Well, it's to me one of the most tragic aspects of these last few years, the ways in which these people have taught to really remove books, remove history, remove knowledge, remove truth from our young people. What else should they be doing other than learning knowledge and truth and history? And so to me, as an educator, as a scholar, you know, it's been deeply tragic.
You're one of the celebrated scholars, authors in the country. What is your next project after this?
Well, I'm trying to figure that out right now. But I'm really excited to celebrate, really, Malcolm's 100th birthday with Malcolm Lives. And I know that Malcolm is looking down on many of the fearless activists around the world, and it's certainly your fearlessness, you know, as we continue to resist this administration and anyone who's trying to subject us.
One of the things that, as I said, I came out of a different school of thought, but getting to have a relationship with Dr. Betty Shabazz meant a lot to me. She spoke in National Action Network. That's her speaking at one of our Saturday morning rallies that I'm showing. And one of the things that she said is that she always wished that a broader audience saw what Malcolm was about. What do you want our white viewers to do and think about Malcolm and young whites to read? Why is it important for everybody to understand what Malcolm X was about?
Well, as I mentioned, Malcolm died advocating for human rights. And he recognized that white people were human too. He recognized that white people too were being.
You're listening to An Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM over the airwaves in the city of Pittsburgh, streaming online to the world up on WRCT.org.
Now everybody comes, everybody goes. What's it all about? No one really knows. Some of them are up, some of them are down. Says what they wanna say, and even when it's not, they say it anyway. Everybody hears what they wanna hear, echo in the halls, in between their clock, staring at your hands.
love that track from Quasi. Janet Weiss just killing it on the drums. Going back to 2013. That was You Can Stay But You Gotta Go off of their album Mole City. You are listening to An Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh. WRCT is supported by Rita's Italian Ice. Rita's offers a variety of frozen treats, including their Italian Ice, made fresh daily with real fruit. Available in over 95 flavors, Rita's has several locations throughout the city of Pittsburgh, including a stand at 3712 Fifth Avenue near the University of Pittsburgh campus. For more information, visit their website at ritasice.com. And if you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. Right now, millions of kids up to age 19 are eligible for free or low-cost health insurance through Medicaid and CHIP. Your child could be one of them. In fact, children in a family of four earning up to $80,000 a year may qualify. Income levels vary by state. Regular checkups, immunizations, doctor and dentist visits, hospital care, mental health services, prescriptions, and more are covered. For more information or to enroll today, go to insurekidsnow.gov. That's insurekidsnow.gov. Families affected by disasters urgently need support. You can help the American Red Cross provide help and hope to those when they need it most. Please donate today. Go to redcross.org or call 1-800-RED-CROSS to help people affected by disasters big and small. Your support is critical. We can't do it without you. We're just going to keep rolling through our promos here. Join Kevin Amos from 6 a.m. to noon each Sunday for jazz, blues, R&B, funk, soul, reggae, and more. And the Saturday Light Brigade features a blend of acoustic music, puzzles, on-air phone calls, community interviews, and live performances from youth and adults, all in a relaxed format that's fun to listen to. Tune into the show that gets your weekend off to a good start. The Saturday Light Brigade, Saturday mornings from 6 to noon on WRCT Pittsburgh. And check out Monochrome Sessions, from weekly improvised DJ sets to live performances on drum machines and synths. Monochrome Sessions delivers a dynamic exploration of electronic sound, a journey where every moment is as bold and timeless as black and white. Tune in every Wednesday at 11 p.m. where Blackwell brings you Monochrome Sessions live on WRCT. And stick around, we got a lot of really far out music. So if you're into the avant-garde, this is going to be a good night for you. Thanks for tuning in. This is An Experiment with Time at WRCT Pittsburgh.
Sus pies.